Hello, please let me see your ticket subs for The Double-Edged Double Bill. This week, historical romances have the sense and sensibility to not catch tulip fever. Adam Thomas and Thomas Mariani will come to the table to discuss the randomly selected yin and yang of a double feature. Then, both will have to pick a number between 1 and 10 in order to seal their fates for the next episode. One will have two good movies, the other two bad ones. Let the chaos begin. I am Thomas Mariani, and I've got a fever, and the only cure is more tulips. But, unfortunately, I kind of lied in that description here for this week, in that my usual co-host, Adam Thomas, is unfortunately not here this evening for this particular episode. He had a last-minute family emergency, which meant he unfortunately could not come on. We hope the best for Adam. We hope everything's good and that he can come back on next week. But I do have someone else here with me who was designed to be our guest this whole time and will now be my co-pilot for the episode, not to put any more pressure on him. He is from another Talk Film Society podcast, It Pod to Be You, that covers romance films of varying different stripes. It is Mr. Manish Mather. Manish, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I've listened to the show. Big fan. Love what you do over there. And I'm glad, especially, that you actually asked me to come on to the show, because apparently you've listened to a couple of the episodes since we joined Talk Film Society.
I really enjoy the show, and both have such good chemistry. It's like a lot of fun listening to it, so I was like, let me just invite myself on here just to plant my flag. So thanks so much for agreeing, and I'm glad you like It Pod to Be You. Thanks for listening.
We would love to have more guests like yourself that want to be on. We force people on. We just like prod, like, please come on.
Yeah.
For the love of God. We have you on here, obviously, because we're doing historical romances in honor of this is coming out in time for Valentine's Day. For all you lovers out there. And we've done, you know, like romantic comedies and romantic dramas, stuff like that previously on the show. But historical romance ones definitely sort of cauterize like a different subgenre. And what do you think separates that particular subgenre from your other experiences with other various stripes of romance film, given you're the expert on this?
Oh, well, I mean, I appreciate that. What I love about historical romance is you can do it in like one of two ways. One is like make it like kind of very like lavish and expensive looking and, you know, have a lot of big stars, or you can kind of do like a stripped down story. And what I find really fascinating about historical romance is how much the filmmakers try to make some kind of connections are between the past and the present. You know, we try to find, like, some of them really try to make them feel more relevant. And also, I think that historical romance can just be, it can be kind of fun to get swept away in it. You know, we don't get a lot of, you know, romantic epics anymore. And so it's fun to see films that kind of take you away to a different time. And you get to see a lot of really great character actors kind of playing roles and having some fun with costumes and makeup and hair. And it's like, I like romance movies. I think when they're done really well, they can be some really exciting, you know, authentic, interesting filmmaking. And when done poorly, as we'll see, it can be kind of frustrating and annoying. Romance is a genre. I mean, I don't, you know, I would love to get your take on this, but I feel like romance can kind of get maligned a lot. You know, my review of Tulip Fever, not to spoil it, on Letterboxd, my review was, you know, movies like this kind of make other movies like this look bad. And because I think people kind of lump all the good and bad ones together as like, oh, it's just kind of easy to like do whatever. But I feel like romance as a genre is a really vital piece of filmmaking. It's, you know, it's been a part of storytelling since forever. So historical romance, it just gives you an opportunity to kind of get more epic, get more grand, and really show off a lot of parts of filmmaking that I think people don't really associate with romance. You know, cinematography and costume design and editing and stuff like that.
I get what you're saying, because, you know, on my end, being just like a cisgender, straight, white dude, I was always sort of programmed from an early age to be like, oh, that's not for me. That's girly stuff. Exactly. I don't like any of that. Like, I remember when I was younger, the big du jour was Titanic. That was like such a big, massive movie. And it was so ubiquitous that I kind of hated that movie for a while, just out of like, oh, it was just everywhere. And then I've gone back to that movie since, another, like, especially the historical romance. It's just like, wow, these are like big and spectacle in a way that, you know, now we get that in the form of, you know, Marvel movies where the most sex is just like a superhero going up to a lady and be like, do you like me? Check X or no? And there's not that much like actual romantic chemistry between people, as opposed to like, the older I get, the more I kind of love the idea of like two people just swooning over each other, especially in a disparate place from long ago. It's really exciting to see that kind of thing. And you know, as you mentioned, like, at its best, it can be something that really captures you and just sweeps you into that period. And at its worst, it can be kind of boring, though I would argue, at least with Tulip Fever, is never boring, because it's just, it's like, oh, we're doing this now?
Okay,
we'll get into that in a second with our topic. Obviously gives us the opportunity to cover a good and a bad film for the evening. Our choices from the end of our last episode, where we did the random picking, were between Adam's good pick, which is Sense and Sensibility, the 1995 adaptation of the Jane Austen novel. And then my bad pick was one that I chose, but the patrons, patreon.com/GEDBpod, ended up voting on that, and thus getting us Tulip Fever, which will be the first film we're covering here. And let's just go ahead and jump into it now with Tulip Fever.
In 1634, Amsterdam was captivated by a flower. Rich and poor gambled on the tulip market. Sophia was a beautiful orphan, chosen by one of the richest men in the city.
Love, honor, and obey.
I've decided to engage the services of a painter.
Don't move.
Put your brush to capturing my wife.
She is a rare beauty. There's nothing without risk.
I love you.
Tell your husband what you've been up to.
What have I done?
I bought Sophia.
I must find her.
You two really think you'll carry this off?
So Tulip Fever came out September 1st, 2017, and though it was directed by Mr. Justin Chadwick, the real sort of auteur here is someone who, we should just get this out of the way about the reason why this film exists, is it was the last film widely released by the Weinstein Company. And it was literally about a month before all the stuff broke about Harvey Weinstein. And his bread and butter was really a lot of these historical romance movies that got him, like, you know, he did all of his, like, campaigning for Oscars that got, like, The English Patient or Shakespeare in Love, rather infamously, or The King's Speech to win the Best Picture Oscars. And he was doing that for a while, especially, like, in the 90s through the 2000s. Even before all the sexual assault stuff came out, he kind of had been dwindling in the last few years that he was actually a film distributor. And, you know, I think I can speak for Adam when I say, and I really hope you agree with me, sir, fuck this guy.
Oh, absolutely.
But it is such a bummer, especially, I'm curious, because of, like, those big movies are, like, really big in that kind of genre of, like, the historical romance. Like, being his bread and butter, does that really, like, make you think back on some of those movies with regret about them being as big as they were? Can you still watch some of those?
Yeah. I don't feel comfortable kind of dismissing every Miramax movie ever made, just because there's so many ones that are just incredible films, like, you know, The Hours. And I mean, he did a lot of work with Tarantino. So, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to be burning their Pulp Fiction, you know, Blu-rays anytime soon. So it's hard. But at the same time, you know, he was just one person. And of course, he had his own whole web of accomplices, I'm sure. But, you know, thousands of people worked on these movies. A lot of actors that I really admire and respect worked on them as well. I think they're important parts of American filmmaking. And I don't want to, I don't feel comfortable being like, you know, no to boycott Miramax forever, especially movies that were made, you know, before any of this came out. this was like the nail in the coffin, as you mentioned. There are so many movies that I really admire from in his catalog. And, you know, I do wince when I see the Miramax logo, you know, in front of a movie, but then the movie starts and it's, you know, most of them are quite brilliant. So I guess the kind of thing I'm thinking is like, well, you know, everyone involved in these movies at some point probably has a story where he victimized them, whether, you know, physically or emotionally or verbally. So all these movies were kind of made in the face of his, you know, tyranny and dictatorship and awful behavior. So, you know, I'm not going to be like, oh, you know, Meryl Streep is complicit because she was in the out. Like, I don't know. That just seems a little extreme for me.
Right. Especially when certain people have spoken out, like Cara Delevingne.
Yeah, exactly. Like, right. She was, yeah.
Like, very made very uncomfortable by him with like his own like sexual harassment, which is a shame. I think it's a whole thing where like that's so much more of an issue when it's someone who's more creatively involved. You know, when somebody who like you can definitely be more irksome as opposed to Weinstein put up the money and more importantly, if anything, like really just damaged the films, even regardless of like the other stuff. He was all, like infamous for like cutting up movies like this movie, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
It was shot in 2014 and it was like went through several screenings and re-edits and stuff like that. And you can kind of tell because every scene feels like it's edited within an inch of its life.
Yeah.
Because it's just like like any scene, it's just like, well, this is the barest minimum setup and then cut to the next thing. This is like an hour 45 minutes, and it feels even shorter than that. It feels very much like a movie that is not given any room to have any kind of, like, depth to its characters or story. It's just like, nope, we gotta keep moving, keep it up.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, my question to you is, like, do you think there's a good movie in here somewhere, or a different adaptation of this novel? Could that have worked? Or because I kind of feel like the story is almost unfilmable. I mean, I haven't read the book, so what do I know? But I mean, any bad book can be made into a good movie. I definitely think that. But I just wonder, like, is this movie even salvageable on any level? Or we just kind of like, it's just like a weird story that just doesn't make a lot of sense. I don't know. I can't figure that out for myself.
Well, it's interesting because there was almost a version of this in 2004.
Okay.
That was like going to be produced by Steven Spielberg and would have starred instead of the actors we get in the main parts, Jude Law, Keira Knightley. I know, shocker, Keira Knightley in a historical romance movie. You've not seen any of those. And then Jim Broadbent.
Yeah.
And directed by John Madden, which I think would have been maybe not a very memorable movie, but at least would have been something that resembles more of a cohesive movie
than
this one. Because my biggest problem with this movie is just that it falls into one area of bad movies that I find fascinating of just like a studio train wreck of just like, oh, hey, we're going to have like five different movies in one. And it just flows like a train that hits a wall, but then has to keep going and move it away from the wall and just keeps hitting more and more walls the whole time. Because like, if you don't know, the basic story of this movie is it takes place in like 17th century Amsterdam. The main character is played by Alicia Vikander, who ends up getting married to this duke of some sort, played by Christoph Waltz. And he's like, oh, you know what? I'm going to get our portrait done by this artist who's played by Dane DeHaan. And as the portrait is getting done, Dane DeHaan grows to have an affection for Alicia Vikander and vice versa. And they have an affair. While at the same time, there's a bunch of other stuff with the housekeeper, played by Holiday Grainger, who ends up getting pregnant by a fishmonger guy, who also is in the middle of the Wall Street of tulips, which was a real thing, apparently.
Yeah.
That people went day trading for fucking tulips at this time. And there's a whole thing where, you know, Holiday Grainger gets pregnant, and Alicia Vikander needs to produce a child for Christoph Waltz, so she pretends to be pregnant. Like I said, 20 different fucking storylines happen in this movie, and none of them work together at all. It's kind of insane.
You can feel the editing of the movie. You can also feel that it was probably, like, given so many notes all the time. And you know, not that, like, Justin Chadwick is some, like, brilliant auteur who needs a director's cut. This movie just feels so, like, by the numbers. They're trying to make almost, like, a parody of a literary adaptation of a famous novel, you know, or at least a popular novel.
It does kind of feel like historical romance movie, like a Scary Movie style parody.
Exactly, yeah.
Where it's just like, we have to parody, like, five different movies. So we'll go from one of the first of these movies to the next. And it's weird because, like, it was written by Deborah Magach, who wrote the novel this was based on, but also Tom Stoppard, who was like a famous like playwright and screenwriter who had done like Shakespeare in Love and all these other things. And you can see aspects of that, like especially all of the farcical stuff feels very Tom Stoppard. But then it's like you said, I totally agree that it goes from being the most traditional version of like one of these historical romances to more of like the farcical thing, some more of these other things, in a way that feels kind of like you're just trying to cover more ground. It feels like it's the last act of a desperate man for like a Weinstein. It was just like, oh, I need to have some kind of relevance again. I'm going to do another one of these historical romance movies. That's like, oh, should we settle on one particular type? It's just like, no, do them all.
This is
my Hail Mary pass. And it's like, oh no, this isn't going to work at all on any level.
Right. And like the most interesting part of this movie is the Wall Street of Tulips part, because like that's unique. That's kind of like a very specific, you know, period of history where tulips were kind of all the rage. And they're in what, Denmark?
Right. Yeah. They're in like Amsterdam.
Whereas like, you know, we've seen a million movies where there's like a pretty wife who's stuck with an old husband and she's getting seduced by some young hot guy. Like that's like, you know, we've seen the movie a million times. And they don't do anything interesting with it. You know, Christoph Waltz is playing like a caricature of like one of those husbands from those movies. Dane DeHaan is like trying to be like Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic, but like not. And Alicia Vikander, I mean, I think she's a very talented actress, but I think she's awful in this movie. Like, she's so lost. She's like, she has no idea how to even play these scenes. Even for someone who's like so talented and like played a robot extremely well, like a year.
Well, it's what's interesting also is this would have been shot around the time of an Ex Machina coming out.
Yeah.
So this feels like kind of her first big break, and it feels like she's kind of nervous behind there. But at the very least, she fits better than anyone else, because we mentioned all these other names of people who are woefully miscast. Like obviously a Dane DeHaan, that was his unfortunate bread and butter after Chronicles. Yeah. Just like, oh, let's put you in anything. And it's you can't put that dude in anything. And they're trying to make him, like you mentioned, the Leonardo DiCaprio for this. And it's like, oh, no, he's flailing. And I think that dude would, like, he hasn't done much after this year was the combination of this and Valerian. And, like, I think there's one other one that I'm forgetting. But, like, 2017 was, like, the last straw.
Yeah, Cure for Wellness.
Yes, Cure for Wellness was the third one. Those three movies bombing this hard, they're not going to attempt to give him big stuff anymore. And he's been doing television now. I hope that dude comes back and just gets to be the weird Brad Dourif-style character actor he should be.
That's
exactly what he needs to do, is just be like a weird, creepy guy in a movie. Just like, perfect. You're so good for that. But, like, there's him, and there's also two people we haven't mentioned that show up in this movie. One, Matthew Morrison of Glee fame. Just he pops up like a fucking jump scare.
That's so weird.
It was so weird. He plays like the bravado badass, like, yeah, I'm a womanizer, I'm going around just like, Will Schuster, get the fuck out of here. No one likes you.
If there's any actor who screams badass, it's Mr. Shu.
I mean, clearly. Remember when that dude did covers for Glee and was on the pop charts? We let that happen? And then the weirdest one being, like, the buddy of Dane DeHaan's artist character, played by Zach Galifianakis, fresh off the Hangover trilogy, which is so weird. It feels like he's also in a different movie where, like, he is in a time travel comedy.
Yeah.
He shows up in Amsterdam from, like, the Hangover movies.
That's pretty funny.
Sense.
Yeah. It's like, I would watch that.
that's true, right? And his whole storyline too, where he has to get the expensive tulip and he gets distracted by saving a donkey, and then everyone's like, our hero, let's get him drunk. When the holy fuck was that?
It's so weird. And like, you know, Dane DeHaan, Alicia Vikander, even Cara Delevingne, like, you can see why they're cast in this movie, because like they're very, like, they're young, they're hot, they're, like, about to break out. But then because this movie gets delayed for, like, a decade or whatever, by the time it comes out, it's, like, even Alicia Vikander is kind of, like, past her It Girl status, you know? Like, she wins her Oscar and kind of, like, goes away for a bit. I mean, she resurfaces for Tomb Raider, which I like a lot. You know, she kind of goes back and kind of has a little, like, fun, quiet life with Michael Fassbender. And Dane DeHaan, as you mentioned, like, his career kind of gets derailed from this year. And Cara Delevingne, I mean, she's living her life, but like, it's so weird. But then, you get to Zach Galifianakis, and I'm like, envision Zach Galifianakis in a movie like this that were a little bit better, a little bit more like self-aware. But like here, it's just like, everything's so like slipshod, it's so haphazard that like nothing makes sense because there's no like connectivity between what's happening in any of these subplots.
No, yeah, especially when, like, the movie will be taken over by any of these characters at any point and leave a lot of other people in the dust, like Holiday Granger, who weirdly is the narrator of this movie, somehow, despite the fact that she's, like, such a side character in the middle of all this, and she's the one I kind of feel the worst for, because this would have been around the time when she was in a bunch of these historical dramas of sorts, and felt like, oh, she could be the one to, like, break out, but then, like, a Florence Pugh basically does that, like, right after this.
Yeah, I mean... And the thing is that, like, I feel that the pregnancy plot, like that should have culminated at the end of the movie, where it's, like, that, like, the climax is, like, the birth scene, where they do, like, the switcheroo and stuff. But that happens, like, way earlier than I remembered. And then the movie just kind of, like, goes on for another, like, I don't know, 25 minutes or so. You're just like, what is happening? I don't care about any of this. Like, but everything got resolved. Like, what's happening?
Right. And it's the weird thing where Christoph Waltz, in theory, should be the villain of the story. And should be just like, oh my god, he's this awful dude who just completely leaves her to the side and then is going to be so angry when this happens. Yeah. And instead he's just kind of like aloof. He's just kind of like in the background, just like, oh, I love that you're doing this. I can't wait for our baby. And then he finds out later, like, oh, I guess she died and doesn't... the scene in particular where, like, Holiday Granger meets back up with Jack O'Connell, who plays the fishmonger guy, and she just exposits the whole reveal while he's, like, 5 feet away. That stuff that feels like it's a fucking parody. It's just like, really? And then Christoph Waltz's reaction just being like, oh, well, I didn't treat her right anyway. You take the house. I'm leaving.
Yeah, there's, like, no drama to it.
No,
like,
no.
Not that I want to see him, like, yelling and throwing things and hitting people, but, like, I feel some kind of, like, tension and danger that... Because, like, I don't know. What's your take on Christoph Waltz as an actor?
He's very good at doing, like, one particular mode. I think that's kind of the thing. It's like he won 2 Oscars for playing the same role, a very good like character, but the same character, basically. One is a hero, one is a villain.
Yeah.
And he's another guy where, like, after Tarantino brought him out to everybody, like, oh my god, he's such a great actor, I can't think of a non-Tarantino movie where he really popped for me.
I feel like we all got tricked into thinking he was some brilliant actor because he was, like, this... Not that he was, like, a newcomer, but, like, he was new to America, I guess. And so we were like, oh, wow, like, here's this, like, cool guy from, you know, Germany or whatever. And then he just does the same thing over and over. I mean, it's like, and this movie, I'm like, this solidifies that. Because, like, he's not even good in this movie and he's playing the same kind of character.
But at the very least, the other people try to imbue him with some kind of conflict. As opposed to, like we mentioned, a guy who's kind of in the background. And then it's just like, oh, you know what? After realizing my entire last few months was a total lie and that my wife has left me, I'm just gonna fuck off and you guys can take the house.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Just like, there's no humanity there. It's just like, what the fuck are you talking about? No one would react like this.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess you would ask me this question. I guess I'll reverse it here. Could you see any kind of a good movie here? Could you see any form of this, even if we took, like, one specific storyline? Like, you kind of mentioned the tulip thing.
Yeah.
Do you think that could even sustain, like, a whole movie on its own or not?
I don't think the tulip thing could have been its own movie. I mean... I hate when people are like, oh, this should be like a miniseries, because I'm like, we should be movies. We can't convert everything into a miniseries, but like, I would love to see like an HBO show about like the tulip, you know, industry of this time. I think if you pick one subplot and then flesh it out, make it a little bit more organic, make it more authentic, you know, do some like major script editing, I think it could work. I think this like trying to tie in the tulips to the pregnancy to... everything else is happening, it just feels so like everything's just so rushed. And you also need you would need a director with more of a visual style than just someone who's trying to replicate, you know, the Miramax you know, look. You know, this movie just feels like the auteur, as you were saying earlier, is Miramax, you know, just like how all MCU movies kind of have that like MCU look. I mean, I feel like that's the same with here, where it's just like this movie just looks like, you know, every movie that's like this.
I guess there's more of a distinction, I guess, between like the Miramax and even the Weinstein Company version of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially right. At this point, it feels so much like it's Harvey Weinstein trying to get that Miramax feel, but because he's working with even less money and has that more of that desperation, it's like, oh, this feels like grungier, but in a way that's completely contradictory to like what the movie's trying to do.
Right.
Because
right.
Like it looks like this version of Amsterdam is like, it looks so grimy and shitty. But not in a way that would be like, oh, that could be like some kind of interesting contrast to the love story. It's like, no, we're still trying to have a romantic, beautiful story that already doesn't work because Dane DeHaan and Alicia Vikander do not have any kind of chemistry. And the plentiful sex scenes fall flat like a fish every time they're like having sex with each other. Just like, oh, this, you guys, especially since we were like, I think Alicia Vikander is supposed to be younger than Dane DeHaan's character, but he always looks like a boy.
He looks like, yeah, 12 years old.
Right. And he's, especially his, even his facial hair looks like boy's first facial hair. Just like, look, I'm a rebel. I have a terrible wispy mustache. It all just like feels miscalculated.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is also, like, there's other things we haven't even mentioned, like Tom Hollander is the weird, creepy doctor that shows up for comedic relief. That's really upsetting.
Yeah, this scene where, like, he's, like, telling her to, like, put her legs in, like, the stirrups or whatever, and he's like, oh, no, it's out of habit. We don't actually need that or something. I'm like, what a weird joke. Again, it's hard for me to, like, watch a movie like this, like, watch a right. scene like that, knowing, like, that, like, Weinstein is probably, like, off-camera, like, getting turned on or whatever, like...
Right, and Tom Hollander looks like he's doing it under duress the
whole yeah, time. Yeah.
A great character actor's just like, oh, my God, I can't...
I know, I felt so bad for him. Because I'm like, I don't want to be creeped out by you because I like you a lot as an actor.
Right, and then also another weird person, Dame Judi Dench showing up as the main nun at the Abbey, who grows the tulips, which sounds like it'd be a much more interesting story to follow. Just, like, how does this nunnery, like, make money through tulips?
Yeah, yeah.
The scenes where Jack O'Connell comes over to try and get the tulips from Judi Dench, and there's that shot where she, like, sits down at her desk with, like, a giant cigar, and she's like, let me tell you how this works. You gotta buy the tulips from me, and then you gotta give me a cut of the profits and shit like that. It's just...
But, like, that's cool.
Right, yeah. But that's a cool idea. Yeah.
I want to see Judi Dench as, like, the tulip, you know, godfather or something.
Yes, exactly. You come to me on the day of my nunnery's big celebration, asking for a tulip.
Exactly. Like, I feel like this nunnery needs to be, like, the front for, like, the tulip mafia. Like, that's what I want to see. But she's just, like, relegated to being, like, you know, Judi Dench in a Judi Dench role. You know, she's been doing this kind of thing since she won her Oscar, you know, in Shakespeare in Love. And it's like, come on, lady, you're much better than this. Even in, like, these kind of, like, safe kind of Oscar-y type movies like Philomena, like, she's so good in that movie. But here it's just like, you're so much better than this.
Well, it helps also that, like, a Philomena is such a simple story that yeah. mainly involves just two characters.
Yeah.
Which I'm fine with more than, like, this elaborate production with these costumes that don't look terrible, and even these elaborate production design details where it's like, oh, this feels like a shitty version of Amsterdam. It really sinks even further, like, oh, all this is for naught. So much not. It's just like, it very much is a movie that only existed to try and get any kind of nominations, which there are plenty of those other historical romance movies that were done just for, like, oh, can we get a costume design thing? Regardless, we've talked about this movie for quite a while. Let's just do quick final thoughts about this one. And especially, I'm curious, where do you think, like, what do you think makes a great historical romance work compared to, like, what this movie doesn't do? Like, what does this do wrong that you love so much about other historical romances by comparison?
Romance, whether historical or modern, lives and dies on two things: characters and a sense of place, like a world that's kind of been built for you. You feel like you live in that place because everything is so fleshed out. And Tulip Fever has bland characters that don't make sense. Characters that kind of act like they're in a movie rather than characters who are, like, living people. And this movie has, like, no sense of time or place. And even in this setting that's kind of unique, where, you know, tulips are kind of like, you know, the hot commodities, doesn't do anything special with that. And it just feels very by the numbers. And what makes it such a awful movie is that there's elements of it that could work, but it's so lazy and it's regressive and it's stupid, and it just doesn't really offer anything new. And in fact, serves to really highlight the stereotypes that people have about romance films. And there's no care to it. There's no tenderness. There's no vision for it either.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo all of that. And I think it's also very adamant about the fact that, like, I think Harvey Weinstein was a guy that kind of helped portray that kind of stereotype about these movies, because he's, like, just pumped those out every single year and really tried to schmooze up to, like, hey, I really want, you know, the nominations, I want to have this under my belt as, like, a trophy, basically, that I made this thing that, like, gets such acclaim. And the trouble is, like, as, you know, more things came out, it just revealed, like, oh, he was a very desperate man on a lot of levels, and that included trying to, like, get his name to be much more present at the cost of the, you know, so many things, much more important things than movies. But at the same time, this is kind of, like, such an appropriate, like, whimper of an ending to that dude's producerial career. All this, like, giant attempts at, like, big spectacle and, like, big sweeping romance and attempts at, like, really getting Oscar Beatty kind of acclaim to just total dead silence and no one giving a shit. I think perfect way to end that dude's career.
Yeah.
It's a very terrible, very bad movie that has been lost to time with good reason.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not even interesting enough to watch as, like, a so bad it's good type movie, you know?
No.
But I agree with you, totally appropriate that this movie kind of ends a career as, like, a shadow of its best self, you know? I mean, ends a production company or distribution company where it's, like, you know, all this horrific stuff happened behind closed doors, and now the result is this, like, you know, skeleton that barely functions as, you know, a piece of filmmaking.
A deservedly whimper of an ending right there, for sure, for him. But now, let's get to a much less whimper-filled film from a much better auteur. We have a Sense and Sensibility.
This holiday season, one motion picture will bring you all the surprises that life and love can offer. Marianne and Eleanor, as different as two sisters can be.
Do you love him?
I do not attempt to deny that I think very highly of him, that I greatly esteem him.
Esteem him? Like him?
The more I know of the world, the more I am convinced that I shall never see a man whom I can truly love.
From Jane Austen's timeless classic.
There's some blue sky, let us chase it!
Comes a motion picture beyond all expectations. Academy Award winner Emma Thompson, Alan Rickman, Kate Winslet, and Hugh Grant. Sense and Sensibility.
So Sense and Sensibility came out December 13th, 1995, from director Ong Lee, and also written by the star Emma Thompson, based on the Jane Austen novel. And I'll briefly have my initial thoughts here, because I know my guest has a lot to say about this particular film. I hadn't seen this movie actually until around the time I was actually getting my second vaccine dose. And I was like in bed, and I was like, oh my God, I need something to cheer me up. And I mean, it's such an incredibly charming movie that I was, you know, kind of against when I was younger, just because I'm like, oh, Jane Austen, not my kind of thing. Obviously, once again, feeding into that weird sexism that I was raised in about these kind of movies. And then you watch this movie and it's incredibly charming, so delightful, one of the best, like, cast of great British actors of that time possible, and a phenomenal turn from a director who had not made a full film in English. He had made a couple movies where one of the languages spoken was English, with, like, The Wedding Banquet and stuff like
that.
This was his first totally English language movie. So I think it's great, and I'll elaborate more on that after. Sir, please, you have the floor to talk, because I believe when we told you this was going to be the movie, you were exceptionally excited, because I believe this is just, like, one of your favorite movies ever, right?
Oh, yeah. This is, like, yeah. I mean, buckle up, kids, because I have a lot to say.
Better go start doing my taxes over here. Go ahead, please.
I mean, exactly. Like, you know, call your wife, tell her you're going to be home late. it's just, like, Ang Lee is, he's one of my guys, you know, like, he's on my Mount Rushmore. I love everything he does. I will live to defend him to my dying days. And this movie was really the first movie that I saw of his, at least, well, is either, I think The Hulk, Broken Mountain, and this movie all kind of saw around the same time. I remember I first saw this movie because my friend, Lauren, bought me the DVD for my 16th birthday or 15th birthday. And I had never seen it before. She was like, oh, you know, I know you love movies and I know you love Jane Austen. Because I was talking a lot about the Keira Knightley Pride and Prejudice movie, which I also love. And so she got this for me as a gift. And I was, sure enough, I watched it. And, you know, this is like during the height of my Harry Potter fandom. So I was playing a lot of like Catch the Hogwarts Professor. And just throughout the years, I've just have kept revisiting it over and over. And the more I watch it, the more I find new details to love about it. And, you know, I shared with you this article I wrote for Talk Film Society about the making of this movie. I wrote it for our Ang Lee retrospective when Gemini Man was coming out. And as I discovered Ang Lee more and more over the last couple of years and seeing how varied his career was, I'm like, how did this Taiwanese filmmaker end up making this very, like, you know, austere Jane Austen adaptation? And, you know, we can get to it, but like the history behind the making of this film is fascinating to me. I mean, but yeah, Sense and Sensibility, I love this movie. I mean, I think that it's just one of the smartest screenplays. It's very funny, very like low-key stripped down, even for a movie that looks as lavish as it does. I think Ang Lee's visual flair is perfectly suited for this movie because he kind of takes the like stuffiness out of Austen adaptations and just brings it into this like kind of modern sensibility. At its core, it's a movie about family. It's a movie about sisters, and it's a movie about classism, you know, friendship and all this and all these things. And I don't know if you've, I mean, since you've watched Ang Lee's movies and having seen The Wedding Banquet and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman and The Ice Storm, it's like, this movie just feels so natural. Even alongside Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it feels very natural. And Brokeback Mountain as well. His work as an auteur, like, it feels like this movie is just a, you know, a beautiful bridge point between his work in, you know, in Eat, Drink, Man, Woman and The Wedding Banquet, and then, you know, his other American films. And I mean, Emma Thompson, I mean, her screenplay is like, I think, an amazing adaptation of the novel, which I read the novel, I think, in high school or in college. This is like a 100 out of 100 movie for me. So I could go on and on about everything that I love about it that's so perfect, but I will let you speak so I can not annoy your listeners.
Oh, yeah, what he said. but no, I mean, I agree, especially considering like some of the things you are kind of referencing, like, particularly that Emma Thompson had written sketch comedy before this in England, but had never written a full screenplay before, is astonishing to me.
Yeah.
Because I haven't read the book, but the way that this story especially does such a great job of conveying that familial relationship with like everyone in the Dashwood family. Like, I totally believe that like Emma Thompson and Kate Winslet are sisters, and that Gemma Jones is the matriarch, is like in this kind of struggle that Emma Thompson has to kind of like help her under. And then also even the smaller one, Fanny, is so fun as like a little sister character, where it totally feels like, oh, these are all people in the same family. These are not actors that they hired.
Oh, sorry, totally... you mean Margaret. Oh, Fanny's the sister-in-law. Sorry. Yeah.
Yes, my apologies. Yes, Margaret, Emile Francois. Yes, she's great. I love that relationship between that main family. It does it's such a great thing of, like you mentioned, in worse hands, you could do like a very stuffy version of the story. That's so much more about like, oh, we have these elaborate costumes we're showing off and the actors are mere mannequins.
Yeah.
Just kind of like deliver it in a pithy sort of British Sense and Sensibility, as it were. But this movie does such a great job of being, like you mentioned, very naturalistic, where it feels like, oh, I'm just there in that time. It feels like I'm very much transported to that period, which is a big credit to like Ang Lee and like the cinematography and everything that really gets you immersed. Like, there's that whole shot where it's Emma Thompson and Hugh Grant are walking on the grounds.
Yeah.
And it's a gorgeous shot of just this field that feels just like I'm there in that field. So many great shots where, like, on paper, once again, just like, oh, there are a bunch of shots of people walking in fields. Why would I be interested in that? And then you watch, and it's just like, oh, no, these are just people living this particular time. And they feel like actual three-dimensional characters who are speaking, obviously, in a way that people wouldn't speak, like, in a modern sense, but in, like, just seeing these actors act so naturalistically and deliver this dialogue so naturally, it feels so wonderful. Down to even like a Hugh Grant being here in the right in the middle of his stammering career, where he's just made his bread and butter. I'm like, excuse me, I'm sorry, I he can't finish a sentence. Here, he does it so briefly and so few and far between that when he is able to have like that kind of stammering, like awkwardness, it really works. Like, I love the scene where Kate Winslet gives him a line reading, basically off the poetry, and the look he gives of just like, who are you and why are you doing this to me, is so good. It's so, it's like you mentioned, so naturally funny. It's so wonderful.
You know, that scene is great. And there's just so many like little character interactions that are just like so funny. Like, one of my favorite scenes also involving Hugh Grant and with Emma Thompson, and they're with Lucy Steele, and everyone's kind of like, everyone knows the secret that Edward is engaged to Lucy, but no one can tell anyone that they know it. And so he comes, sees Lucy's there, and then just like sits for like 5 seconds and then just like gets up and leaves, and it's very funny. It's just like, it's just awkward. Oh, another really great moment is there's a scene where like Mrs. Dashwood and Marianne are both crying about, you know, Willoughby or something. And then Margaret starts crying because no one's telling her what's going on. And then Emma Thompson just kind of sitting there with like a cup of tea, just being like, what do I do with these like three crying women?
And it's very funny because, like, you're not laughing at these characters. Like, Ang Lee, if I recall correctly, he said that he hadn't read this novel because he thought it was, like, for girls. So he was very much in that lane of, like, you know, this is girl stuff, I'm a boy, which is very funny because his movies are, I think, very feminine. But, you know, I think because of this, because of Emma Thompson's screenplay and these characters and these performances, he's resisting kind of laughing at this, but rather like laughing with them, with all this, like, you know, romantic entanglements and, you know, betrayal, you know, like Marianne spending hours crying about not getting a letter or getting a letter that she didn't want to get. But it's like, it's funny, but it's also like you feel for her, and it's heart-wrenching. It's so smart to hire a comedian to write the screenplay, because especially someone like Emma Thompson, who's incredibly intelligent, and obviously she's very good at comedy and drama as an actress, so she naturally can pick out both those elements from the screenplay. And then, you know, Lindsay Doran, we should mention, is a producer who, this is her passion project. This has been something that she had been, you know, wanting to do for her entire career after doing movies like This Is Spinal Tap and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Like, she's a very prolific producer before this film, and then she like created this project out of thin air and was like, I love this novel, let's do it. Found Emma Thompson, and then was like, let's get an international guy to do this movie. And they found Ang Lee off the strength of The Wedding Banquet. You wouldn't think this movie, which is like, you know, as you're saying, could be seen as Oscar bait, very stuffy adaptation, you wouldn't think it would have this like fascinating genesis, but it's really quite interesting. And then the production, there's so many stories of these British actors not knowing like how to react to Ang Lee's style of filmmaking, because it's very different, I guess, in his homeland than it is in England. Like one thing they mention is how unused he was to actors making suggestions, because that's just not how he was brought up to do it. But eventually they all kind of figured it out and they found a balance. And I don't think anyone from this movie speaks any ill of Ang Lee. I don't think anyone, I've never heard anyone say anything negative about Ang Lee as a filmmaker, as a leader on these projects. But, you know, they found that balance. And, you know, what I love about this movie is all about finding the balance between love and friendship, between sisters who are opposites, between, you know, the rich and the poor, between the city and the country, you know. There's all these ways that everything can be true at once without anyone having to like win or lose. It all kind of comes together.
Yeah, I think it's because despite Emma Thompson and Ang Lee being very different people creatively, they both have like a similar respect and like for empathy.
Yeah,
for characters.
Absolutely.
I think that's what really works. Is like so much of it, the way that whether he represents it visually or she represents it on the page, does such a great job of really presenting like, look, you like these people are real, despite the fact that they're people from this old dusty book that was on your library shelf at school. They find a real humanity that really works for those characters, particularly with like the Kate Winslet character. You really are kind of swept up in her like love, her growing like crush on Greg Wise as Willoughby.
Yeah.
Like the moment that dude shows up like on a horse saving her from the fog, you're just like, oh, he's my hero too. I'm so glad. And then when you find out his deception, you are similarly hurt with her. Just like, I can't believe that man did that to you, but me also, the audience member. How dare he do that to me? Those lovely sideburns, they fooled me. I can't believe it.
You know, credit to Jane Austen as well. I think her novels are bitingly funny and very, I mean, the reason why there's so many adaptations that come out. I mean, we recently got, you know, a new Emma with Anya Taylor-Joy. There's so many Jane Austen movies from India as well, which is, you know, you wouldn't think it, but they're so relevant to today's time period. And her observations about, you know, relationships and friendships still relevant today. You know, we all know a Lucy Steele. We all know a Fanny Dashwood. We all know a Mary Ann's. You know, we all know a Willoughby too. I mean, Willoughby is like, you know, the Dane DeHaan of that time. But so, yeah, I mean, it's really, I think, quite a wonderful movie. And I agree with you about the empathy. And I agree that like you get swept up. I mean, I get swept up by Willoughby, and I've seen this movie a million times. I'm like, you know, he comes in with his flowers that he plucked from the field, and he's reciting Shakespeare, and I'm like, you know, marry me. I mean, everyone is like swept up by him. And I think even with his deception, there's some empathy for him too, because they show him at the end watching the wedding from afar. And I'm like, man, this guy, I think he actually did love Marianne. He just couldn't marry her.
you feel for him. Obviously, he did awful things in the past as well, but there's still that empathy there. The movie is so complicated, even for its simplicity.
Right, yeah, because immediately, like, the first time I watched this, when it immediately starts off with, like, Tom Wilkinson dying, it's like, okay, so he's got the second family that is getting completely cut off, and then there's the other family that's moving in. It's a lot of information to soak in initially, but then once we especially just focus so much on the Dashwoods, it, like, you immediately get the entire dynamic of the family and how, like, you know, Emma Thompson's trying to help her mom keep the family afloat, while the two younger sisters, despite being very different in age, have a similar kind of flight of fancy to them, and there's that kind of conflict that's there, but you really believe that, like, especially Emma Thompson and Kate Winslet, so many scenes, like the bit where Kate Winslet basically finds out that Willoughby's been a liar this whole time, and Emma Thompson's just like, well, did he say he was going to marry you? Yes! No, I mean, I don't know. And it's like, that feels very natural. Like, oh, these, despite the fact that they're, you know, these people that we, especially younger, know, like, oh, Kate Winslet, Emma Thompson, such higher esteemed peers. It's like, oh no, they're like kids who don't know what the fuck they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a real charm to that, despite the fact that we've just been roped up. There's a lightness that's there, but all the emotions feel very grounded and sincere. And the stakes from their perspective feel so real. So once again, when Kate Winslet's crying, they're just like, I can't believe that man did you wrong.
Yeah.
You deserve to not have that happen. Or even with, like, Emma Thompson, it's like, no, go to Hugh Grant. He's so charming. He doesn't stutter that much. He's the perfect version of Hugh Grant. Go to him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, exactly. And Kate Winslet's, I think she has a really hard character because it can be easy to kind of get annoyed by a character like that because she's so impulsive and she's so, like, you know, she gets swept up so easily. But I think there's such a humanity to her too. And, you know, another scene I love is when they're at that ball and she sees Willoughby and she goes, Willoughby, loudly, and it kind of stops the party. Willoughby's fiance is Sophia Gray. I remember her neck being really long in that scene. And in the book, Jane Austen mentions her having a really long neck. And I was like, wow, what great casting for this extra who has no lines.
These situations are just so relatable. You know, we've all kind of embarrassed ourselves at a party, you know. We've all had guys who are like, you think you're in a relationship with them, but you're kind of not because they actually never say it. And you're like, wait, what's happening? So it's just like, it's relatable. And I think this, the screenplay and the direction really emphasize that. And Ang Lee, what I love about him is that he is able to make these, like, really gorgeous visuals without being too obvious about it. Like, he just has this, like, elegant style to him that's, like, lushly romantic and lavish, but without, like, too much, like, ornate decoration or too much, like, grandiosity, like Alejandro Gonzalez in Iñárritu, you know, like,
right, where it's not, like, extremely showy. We're just like, look at how great this shot is. Ang Lee's just like, here's my shot. Doesn't look
exactly good. Yeah.
Right.
There's a bit more of, like, a humbleness that's there. Yeah, I agree. And even, like, he'll make, like, so much of this movie is just people talking back and forth with each other, but still feels so visually dynamic. Like, someone who, for some reason, we haven't mentioned that much, it's a shame, Alan Rickman.
Oh, yeah.
Colonel Brent, who is such a wonderful, complete contrast to what, obviously, like, you mentioned the Harry Potter thing. We were younger, we know him so much as Snape, or even older people would know him from, like, Die Hard.
Yeah.
Right, and it was immediately just like, oh, the baddest villain around, the great British evil villain of all time. And here he's such a quiet, lovely man. And the scene where he talks to Emma Thompson and just reveals all the things about, like, I had a ward, basically, but I took this child and I gave her too much freedom, all this other stuff. It's such a visually dynamic scene, just the way that he's standing in repose the entire time while Emma Thompson is sitting down. We're, like, in Emma Thompson's point of view, basically. Just,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
We're on the edge of our own seats, just like, oh no, Alan, no. I can't believe this happened to you, Alan.
Yeah, and, like, Colonel Brandon just being the most, like, useful person in the world, like, yes. He just always seems to know what to do. And I agree. And I think a lot, like, that scene between them is so visually dynamic, even if it's back and forth editing, but it's the performances are so visceral. The direction is so light of touch and nimble, and the writing is so strong that
it feels so dynamic, even for something in lesser hands could just be, like, you know, point and shoot and shot, reverse shot.
Yeah, and especially for, like, Rickman, who was so typecast at this point, the way that he has, like, such a true empathy, but a real respect, even for, like, Willoughby, where he talks about, you know, I think he did truly love her. And it's a, you know, it's a shame that all this other stuff, like, that's the kind of thing where there's no, like, villain in this movie, really. You could easily make Willoughby just, like, the evilest man possible.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But nobody is truly out and out a villain. Some people can be antagonistic, but in a way that, like, just feels natural for people to be that way. It doesn't feel like anybody is, like, totally in the wrong as much as, like, no, these are people living their lives, and sometimes that conflicts with another person trying to live their life. It makes it, once again, this kind of stuffy, in theory, material feel so much more natural, so much more human, in a way where I'm like, shit, I wish I'd seen this earlier. This would have, yeah, like, opened my door to a lot more of these movies that could have hopefully, like, but then again, because this is one of your favorites, do you think other, what do you think other, like, sort of costume romance dramas like this can really learn from, like, what Ang Lee put to it? Do you think there are other films that have, like, even come close in a similar way?
I mean, I would say that the 2005 Pride and Prejudice comes very close. I mean, that's another all-time favorite. Mm-hmm. And I think what the two movies have in common is that the visual language is very elegant and specific, and there's a vision to it. You know, Joe Wright is a very visionary filmmaker, especially, you know, in his movies like Pride and Prejudice, Atonement, Anna Karenina, Hannah. You know, those four, I think, especially have such a, like, unique vision to them. And the characters, you know, feel real. They feel relatable. The films are able to kind of pluck out this, like, modern feel from these stories and kind of flesh out what makes Jane Austen so vibrant and so vital, even, you know, centuries later. So I think that the thing to learn is, like, you need to have some kind of, like, visual design that feels cinematic and feels something that you, like, built yourself rather than trying to emulate a style of a movie. And you need, the writing has to be sharp. I mean, even I think the 2020 Emma does a really good job of this as well. I think I'm a big fan of that movie, where it's like, you know, Autumn de Wilde, who directed that film, she has a very specific vision as well, where it's like, her vision is very, like, pop, feminine, very colorful. That movie is very funny. I mean, Emma, I think, is Jane Austen's funniest book, in my opinion, but that movie really highlights the comedy and highlights, you know, makes Emma a very flawed but lovable character. I think going back in time, you know, the Merchant Ivory films, I think, were excellent at this, because those movies were like, you know, like Howard's End, Maurice, Remains of the Day, A Room with a View. They're so dynamic. They're so sensual. You know, you wouldn't expect them, like Howard's End, to be like sensual. And The Room with a View especially is a very sensual movie. And then we have like graphic nudity as well, which you would not expect. There's a heat to them. And I think there's a heat to Sense Sensibility as well. These characters are, you know, they might be like repressed and British and whatever, but they also kind of wanted to like have sex with each other. They wanted to have these like advantageous marriages, and they wanted to like get together and like get matched up. And it was kind of like, you know, the unspoken thing is like, it's kind of all about getting it on. So you have to like remember that and like kind of bring that like intensity and heat to it. And, you know, Tulip Fever fails by like having a lot of sex scenes that aren't sexy, because there's no sensuality there. There's no like passion or heat or intensity there. Whereas like Sense Sensibility, like you kind of feel that intensity between Willoughby and Marianne. And you kind of feel it as well with Hugh Grant and Emma Thompson too. Like, these people might have lived hundreds of years ago, but they're still people. They still had all the same, you know, flaws and whatever that we have.
Yeah, I think especially with, like, I joked about this with Marvel movies, but in general, like, modern cinema has been so sexless.
Yeah, oh God, that's a whole other podcast.
Well, that's true. It's a very other podcast, but I really think it fits. Like, even though this movie has no, like, nudity or graphicness to it in any degree, it still has a lot more of, like, a sensuality that, like, really builds up between characters, where you believe, once again, like you mentioned, like, the Marianne and Willoughby back and forth, that tension that's really there between the two of them, and that which makes the crushing disappointment work so much later, and then also makes how reliable, like, the Colonel is so wonderful, because it just feels like, oh, you can have that, like, earlier, like, passionate flight of fancy romance that you have when you're younger, but then realize, oh, someone who's actually stable and, like, really cares about you is what matters even more.
Colonel Brandon carrying Marianne at the end of the movie, and he's like limping because he has his injury, and he's like older, obviously, and it's raining. That to me is like hotter than like anything that, you know, the MCU has done. Now, I'm not an MCU hater. I love the MCU. I watch everything over and over again, you know, but it's like tangibly sexy. It's sexy because like he's in pain and he's supporting her. And this is just, this is one of a thousand ways that he's going to help this family. He's like you're saying, he's reliable, he's sturdy, he's affectionate. I think as Marianne starts to realize that, she sees him in a whole new light, and he sees her as, like, in some ways, like, they're also kind of bridging the gap between each other. Like, he can become more, like, romantic and impulsive, just how she can become more stable and responsible. So it's like the chemistry is that, like, all these characters are kind of learning to be a lot like each other and finding, you know, complementing each other's flaws with each other's strengths. You know, there's that, like, it's like that back and forth that's so, that just adds to the romance of it.
Wow, I mean, that's all fine and good, but I remember Steve Rogers kissed his crush's grandniece, and I was just so enthralled by that. So I don't know. I think it's very, they're very even level.
It's neck and neck. Yeah.
It's neck and neck. for sure. But no, yeah, I agree. And especially, it's so weird considering, like you mentioned, that Ang Lee's weird career, where after this he would make stuff like The Ice Storm, you know, going into eventually, like, speaking of MCU, like The Hulk. Like, I find his career so fascinating because he still, I think, carries that kind of empathy throughout his movies, even as he became so obsessed with, like the high frame rate thing
later on.
Like, he still, at the same time, really cares about his characters, even in movies I'm not as huge on, like a Gemini Man or Billy Lynn's Halftime Walk. But you can tell he has that same kind of care and respect for his characters, despite the fact that, you know, there's potential cultural differences or anything else like that. He has this really profound empathy that really carries throughout all his movies, that makes, like, it's the one real tether that makes him feel like, you know, all these disparate kind of movies feel of a piece. Like, where do you think this really kind of, like, helped evolve his career after this point?
I think Ang Lee is interested in a couple of different themes that kind of recur in these disparate films. One is, like, family dynamics, like repression, and also, like, the relationships between adults and children, or like older people and adult children, and James Shamus, who was his collaborator and writer. And he says that The Ice Storm is like the mirror version of Sense Sensibility. And because Sense Sensibilities are people who live in, like, a repressed era, who, like, learn to, like, be themselves and to follow their hearts. And The Ice Storm is all people who live in, like, the free love era, who are even more repressed and
one might say cold in the middle of the ice storm.
Right, exactly. And they're the ones that are fumbling with their, like, romantic and erotic desires, and they can't figure out how to, like, function normally. And they're doing all these things that don't make sense, right? His two previous films, Sense Sensibility, Ice Storm, Brokeback Mountain, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Less Caution, I think are a lot similar. They have a lot of common themes, and I think the genius of Ang Lee is that we might not be able to tie them all together. I didn't notice a connection between The Ice Storm and Sense Sensibility until he pointed out to me. I think, like, Crouching Tiger and Brokeback Mountain are, like, almost the same movie, and which I don't think I noticed until he pointed it out. So it's like he's like so much smarter than all of us combined. He kind of has all these themes and ideas that he's running through, and I think he explores them through these different genres, these different environments, these different countries. And I mean, I would even say that, like, Life of Pi, Tiki Woodstock, Gemini Man, and Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk are all extremely connected to each other in terms of, like, masculinity and finding yourself and being in a very strange environment and trying to understand your own desires versus societal expectations. So I think he's always thinking about these things. I mean, I really resist the idea that Ang Lee kind of lost his way after Less Caution. You know, I mean, I love Life of Pi. I think that's, like, a top five favorite movie for me from him. But I really resist that because I think he is thinking about all these themes. And I think now he's doing it through his technology, which, you know, your mileage may vary. I'm like, look, do what you want, you know, we will catch up to you. I think as his career evolves, he's, like, finding new ways to tinker with these ideas that he has. And, you know, to see his progression from his first film, Pushing Hands, to Sense Sensibility, you can see him maturing and kind of getting a better handle on his visual language. You know, I mean, the jump from, you know, The Wedding Banquet to Eat, Drink, Man, Woman is pretty significant. And then to go to Sense Sensibility is also very significant. I mean, I think Eat, Drink, Man, Woman is a masterpiece as well. So he's always improving and he's always finding new variations on these themes and on these ideas. He has a very eclectic career. And, you know, we always talk about how versatile he is. And of course he is. But his auteurism comes to the fact that, like, his themes are always kind of constant, and he's always finding
unique twists and turns on these common themes that he loves to play with.
Yeah, even down to like with Hulk, like the strength of that movie, I would argue, and why it kind of feels underrated amongst like that era of comic book filmmaking, is how like it's so ingrained in like the family dynamics between like especially like Sam Elliott and Jennifer Connelly. That like those right. scenes are like so electric and powerful in a way where it's just like, oh yeah, there's a green monster that shows up later in this movie.
Right.
This, and even then with the green monster has that with the human comic book character Nick Nolte as his dad being just like a asshole Frankenstein man. We will get to that at some point. I want to cover that movie extensively because that movie is fascinating.
You know what? If you do, please have me on because we will never get a superhero movie like that again.
No, not never again.
Because we, at the time, we, and I say we because I myself did not like that movie when I first saw it.
Right.
I didn't know who Ang Lee was at the time, so that's probably why, but...
Right, and I was an 11-year-old who was just like, Hulk smash! And it's like, wait, what's this family dynamic bullshit? Like, I don't care.
Exactly, and well, because we at the time did not get it and did not appreciate that, like, he's trying to make a very, like, serious, like, melodrama around this comic book movie, and that this is, like, a natural progression from Ice Storm and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and then to this, it's like, it all builds to each other. It all builds upon each other. So I won't say that the Hulk is like my favorite Ang Lee movie, but I definitely am someone that feels like we need to keep watching it to understand what he's doing because he's on a different wavelength. And like, he's trying to do a million different things. Like do this like father-son story, father-daughter story, like a movie that's like a comic book on screen. Like, again, he's so much smarter than all of us. He's always thinking like 8 steps ahead of us. So I'm like, look, if you're gonna alienate everyone by just following your desires, go for it, man. I'm there with you. I will defend you. Like, he's just like, yeah, he's the greatest guy. You know, I could go on for another 3 hours about every movie of his and how great it is. But
yeah, we've been going a while just on vaguely on Sense and Sensibility, but yeah. In general. So why don't we go ahead and at least wrap up? If you can at all summarize your thoughts briefly on Sense and Sensibility,
if you are someone who does not think they like romance movies or Jane Austen adaptations, I really, really recommend you to watch this film. It's a great movie and it's a great Austen adaptation and it's a great romance film. But above all, I think it's a movie where everyone involved makes the 100% correct decision from start to finish. From Lindsay Doran having the idea all the way through, you know, the last day of production or post-production or whatever. Even if you're someone that doesn't like this kind of movie, I think this is the best expression of this kind of movie. So like, just watch it to appreciate like what a movie like this can be like when it's working on all cylinders.
Yeah, I mean, I second all that, obviously. And I think it's also just interesting, given 1995 gave us two very modern versions of Jane Austen adaptations between this and Clueless.
Yes, yes.
Which is an adaptation of Emma. And I think they're both really great studies in how to take that kind of story and modernize it, even though this movie stays close to the period and is more faithful. At the same time, it does have this modern sensibility that we're referring to, where like all the characters feel incredibly like real, and their interactions, it feels like they've been together forever at this point. It's such a great example of how to, like, you can modernize it totally like a Clueless and have fun, but you can also do that with the actual text and just have it be like, we can keep the text but have more of a natural flow to the dialogue and just cast the best people.
Yeah,
and it shows just all of these people at like so the top of their game. And we were like, yeah, I was somebody who similarly was, I'm not as learned on these like historical romance movies, but at the same time I can get really swept up all the way down to, you know, like when Emma Thompson cries about Hugh Grant, I'm crying with her. It's like, yeah, yes, you get to him. It's so beautiful. Like it really like sweeps you up, despite, you know, not being a huge Jane Austen or historical romance person. You really get the emotional heft of it. It still feels very relatable and human, despite it being, you know, people in stuffy British times. It's incredible.
I fully expect to weep when I am proposed to, because I'll be like Eleanor, thank God someone wants to marry me. But no, I mean, you're right. You're just right there with the characters at all times. Yeah.
Yes.
You really feel it.
Well, if we can, we must move away, unfortunately, from Sense and Sensibility. Because after we discuss our two films, usually here we do a segment called The Double Redo, where myself and usually Adam and our guest are open to recommend and not recommend a couple movies based on the topic that we're doing. So basically recommend the best possible double feature and the worst possible double feature related to, in this case, historical romance films. And I'll start with mine. And I also have Adams that I'll briefly state as well. But first, I'll go ahead and do mine. My good picks I have. First is, we kind of mentioned this movie earlier, Joe Wright's adaptation of Anna Karenina, which is a story that, like, I haven't read the book on that one either. I remember when this came out, it was a similar thing, like, oh, you know, the stuff that I wasn't really interested in. And that movie does such a stellar job of making that story feel so, not necessarily human, but theatrical, in the way that the big gimmick that Joe Wright decided with the story is, I'm going to stage it all in a literal stage, like an old dusty theater. So whenever they're, like, say, at a wedding banquet, it goes from, like, the top of the stairs is the actual stage, and they come down into where the audience would be for the actual dance that occurs. And it's, I think, got such a great stellar cast. Some people from one of our movies today with, like, Cara Delevingne and Holiday Grainger, but also it's probably my favorite of those era of the Keira Knightley just doing all these historical romance movies. Probably the best use of Aaron Taylor Johnson in any movie, to be fair. And an incredible Jude Law. Like, I love Jude Law in general, but that is such a great example of, like, playing a character who at first appears so cold, but does have a true empathy to him that still is complicated by his relationship with Keira Knightley. And it's so stellar, it's so beautifully shot, and I love, the, like, the costumes, but also the, just obviously, that gimmick feels so immersive to the point where you just feel like you're in that theater in the middle of that environment, and you only kind of notice after a certain point, like, oh, wait, we're in the middle of, like, a theater setting, and how cleverly they stage that, where, like, the homes are backstage versus the actual seating areas, like, become almost, like, a different environment, like, they go to a fucking racetrack in the middle of this theater. It's just beautifully transformed. There's so much stellar stuff there. I really would recommend that movie. The other good one I have is Jane Campion's The Piano. The Piano was another one where I didn't know anything about it when I was younger. It was just like, oh, that's an adult movie. And then going back to it, it's just like, oh man, this, despite being like full of period era costumes and stuff, it is hot. It is a genuinely, like, once it's a very sexy movie that's about something so seemingly unsexy about, like, a Scottish woman who can't speak is betrothed to this guy in New Zealand, who is Sam Neill, and there's no real romantic chemistry that's there, and all she wants to do is express herself through her piano, which is taken by Harvey Keitel, who works for Sam Neill, and is just like, look, I'll have the piano here, but you can go ahead and, like, practice on the piano, teach me how to play the piano, which is all a ruse just because, you know, he thinks she's hot, and they eventually grow to have an affair, and it's such a great movie about, like, communication between people, and how that casting of, like, oh, hey, Holly Hunter and Harvey Keitel are, like, really hot for each other. Not in a million years would I imagine that working. That's crazy that that would work at all, but it somehow does. It's such a great display of, like, Jane Campion's ability to, like, really direct actors and, like, really trust them to perform this stuff so realistically, down to Anna Paquin was 9 years old in this movie playing Holly Hunter's daughter, won a goddamn Oscar. Still one of the youngest people to ever win an Oscar. It's insane. But still, yeah, a very stellar movie. If you kind of avoid it for similar reasons, I would firmly recommend it. It kind of transcends the stereotypes of that genre. And then my two bad, just briefly, I have Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies, another Jane Austen adaptation, where this was from the Seth Graham Smith adaptation of the novel that he did as a novel himself, where it was just like, oh, what if we take the text of Pride and Prejudice and add zombies into it? And that sounds like a fun skit. And then if you read the novel, it's kind of like, oh, it's just occasional passages of zombies popping up in Pride and Prejudice. And then you watch the movie, and it's just like, oh, it's a bad Pride and Prejudice adaptation with a bad zombie movie. Horror fans and historical romance fans get nothing out of this. It's so dull and lifeless, far more than a zombie. It is such, like, a complete waste of time and effort. And then this other one I have is Tell It to the Bees, who, speaking of Anna Paquin, is in this movie where plays this woman who has a young son, and they're kind of destitute, so they end up going over to Holiday Granger's house because she has inherited this house from her beekeeper father. It takes place in, like, the 1950s, and Anna Paquin ends up, you know, staying there with her son and grows to have a repressed sort of sexual relationship with Holiday Granger that's interesting initially, and then it gets kind of, like, it's so much more about buildup, but in a way that's kind of, like, not necessarily enticing you to see them get together, but just sort of dull. And then weirdly, this romance movie, like, spoilers, I guess, ends with, like, a big horror sequence involving bees attacking people. It's such a baffling note for like the third act of this movie to go out on them. Just like, I don't even know what the fuck you're doing, guys. It's such a weird, bizarre movie that I saw at a festival and promptly forgot about it. And most people have forgotten about it because it feels like it's just not a movie that exists to any degree. But those are my choices. I'm sure you've seen some of these.
I've seen your two good choices. Anna Karenina, yeah. I mean, everything you said is completely accurate. I think it's a really fascinating movie. Another movie that I think did not get its fair shake when it came out. I think a lot of people found the setup really alienating, but it's quite a brilliant film. And the piano, I mean, like, you just remind me, I need to get the Criterion 4K disc.
Yes.
It's a great movie. And yeah, I have not seen the other two movies, but I have read the novel Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. I think I read it in like high school or whatever. I thought it was very clever, but I'm sure at this point, I'm sure it's kind of lame. I guess when I was in high school, you know, who knows what I was thinking. But yeah, I didn't really want to watch the movie. I haven't even heard of Tell It to the Bees. So I guess I'll not check that out.
Well, you have some choices for us as well. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, so my first good choice is Howard's End, the Merchant Ivory movie, also with Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins and Helena Bonham Carter. It's a really lovely movie, also in the Criterion collection. And it all kind of revolves around this kind of beautiful property of Howard's End. And Emma Thompson plays a woman who befriends Vanessa Redgrave. And on her deathbed, Vanessa Redgrave wills the property Howard's End to Emma Thompson, but the family does not want her to have it. But then so no one really tells her. And then she kind of falls in love with Anthony Hopkins, who I believe is, oh, it's been a while. I think it's Vanessa Redgrave's either her brother or her son or her nephew or something. So she ends up living there anyway. So it's this really kind of like romantic story about these kind of like families kind of clashing together. I'm a big fan of the Merchant Ivory movies, especially this film and A Room with a View, which I also recommend. I think people will think of them as stuffy and kind of boring, but they're very dynamic. They're very intense and very funny at times, and really beautifully made. I mean, Howard's End is such a beautiful film. And then my other recommendation for the double feature would be Far From the Madding Crowd from 2015, starring Carey Mulligan and Matthias Schoenaerts, directed by Thomas Vinterberg, from Another Round. And this is another movie that I feel like it kind of doesn't really exist anymore. It kind of came, I think it was supposed to be kind of an Oscar play, but I guess it didn't really go through with it, but it kind of revolves around Carey Mulligan playing Bathsheba Everdeen, who inherits a farm and is working on there. And it's sort of her like romantic entanglements with the various men around her. And, you know, her as like this independent landowner in a time when women weren't really running property like this. You know, it is a beautifully made film, but it's kind of beautiful in a kind of different way. You know, Thomas Vinterberg, I think, is a fascinating director. You know, he kind of does this like romantic novel, like, but it's very like stripped down, like kind of gritty looking. It's not very lavish in the sense of like what we think of lavish, but it's a really kind of cool looking movie. The cinematography especially is something that I wanted to recommend. And Carey Mulligan's performance, really great. I mean, she's a top talent in my opinion, but she's really good in this movie, as is Matthias Schoenaerts. So I recommend looking out for that as well. If you're kind of in the mood for these kind of historical romance, I think this is a really good modern one. And then for my bad films, one is The Ola Bolin Girl, also directed by Justin Chadwick, starring Scarlett Johansson, Natalie Portman, and Eric Bana. It's kind of a retelling of the Anne Boleyn story. I liked this movie a lot when I first saw it in college, but that was also like the peak of my like Scarlett Johansson obsession. But I think this movie's kind of like, it's kind of dull. It's very Tulip Fever-like in that like a lot happens. None of it really kind of coheres together. It's not very sexy. Performances are kind of all over the place. I mean, I do think the central trio is at least trying. You know, they're all really amazing actors, but this movie just kind of blah. And I chose it because of the Tulip Fever connection, same filmmaker, a lot of the same problems where it's like these like weird story that just like doesn't really gel together at all. It's not very sexy for like one of the most famous kind of like sexual you know, scandals of, you know, in the historical era, you know, it's not very exciting, or nor does it really go anywhere kind of interesting. And then my final film is Vanity Fair, directed by Mir Nayar. Now, I hate to say anything bad about Mir Nayar, but this is one of her weaker efforts. She's an incredible filmmaker, but this movie, I think, I just kind of got away from her, I think. It's based on a novel called Vanity Fair, stars Reese Witherspoon. And it's basically a movie about a woman named Becky Sharp who is trying to kind of get rich, marry rich, or just kind of get ahead in society, get kind of a name for herself. And she kind of goes through all these like misadventures as she's trying to like find ways to, you know, elevate her status in society. I would say this movie looks really beautiful. You know, some of it takes place in India, which is kind of pretty to look at. And I think Reese Witherspoon is trying really hard, but I think it's almost too early in her career for her to take on a role like this now, if she were to do it in this sort of like post Big Little Lies era. I think she kind of could pull it off, but this movie was made in 2004. So she's a little early in her career, and she's like trying a little too hard to kind of shake off her like good girl image from her like romantic comedy films and Legally Blonde. So it's also just kind of boring. It's 2.5 hours long, which I don't mind, but for a movie this long, it feels very rushed and also slow at the same time. So I can't really find that tone. It's not that the story isn't interesting. Becky Sharp is a kind of a fascinating character to follow, but it's just kind of dull. And a lot of the supporting characters kind of feel the same. And it's hard to kind of keep track of what's happening. So it's not a really good movie, as much as I hate to say it, because it has a lot of people that I admire working on it. Again, there's no intensity to it. There's no heat to it. There's no tension. It's just kind of like goes from one scene to the next until it ends.
Yeah, admittedly, I have not seen any of your films. I've wanted to see Howard's End, especially because, like, as sort of a bookend, because weirdly, Emma Thompson won her acting Oscar for that one, and then she obviously won for Sense and Sensibility her screenwriting Oscar, one of the few people to do that.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I hadn't. But I will say The Other Boleyn Girl is kind of the movie when I was younger, I would immediately think of all of these historical romance movies as.
Yeah, yeah.
Just these kind of movies were just like, I don't know, I'm not that interested. Now, especially at that time, I was a big Natalie Portman fan. And I was just like, I would have been all on board for most of her other movies. And then The Other Boleyn Girl just looks like, yeah, this looks dull. I don't know if I have much interest. And I guess that was based on you and other people I've heard. That's pretty accurate about that one.
Yeah.
And then I'll just briefly state Adams here that he provided me earlier, which are his good were the Jane Eyre from 2011.
Oh, yes.
And Dangerous Liaisons. And then his two bad were the 1995 version of The Scarlet Letter and actually Emma from 96.
Oh, the Gwyneth Paltrow one?
The Gwyneth Paltrow one, yes.
I would love to hear what he has to say about that. I might ask him. Because I mean, I can't say that's a favorite, but I do like that movie, so I'd be curious. But I think those other picks make a lot of sense.
I had only seen actually recently the Jane Eyre adaptation a couple days ago, and that movie is stellar, especially it's Cary Fukunaga doing far more of like he saw the like gothic romantic drama, let's emphasize on the gothic really hard, and that movie looks so much like a sort of like Hammer horror film, but at the same time it keeps that romance and drama so central. And it does such a great job of that, and especially that was at the time when Michael Fassbender was new. And it's just like, oh, all the promise that you had right before you had a pretty solid career for a bit, and then just completely nosedived and have not made a movie in years. It's so weird with that, dude. I want him to come back. I want the Michael Fassbender comeback, and I don't know if it'll happen. But also, probably one of the better uses of Mia Wasikowska, a similar person who, like, I really liked in stuff like The Double and other things like that, and then she also has kind of, like, seemingly disappeared and faded to the background, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But that is our double reduced segment. We'll repeat our titles as we usually do here. I'll just say my two good once again were the 2012 version of Anna Karenina and The Piano, and then my bad were Tell It to the Bees and Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And I'll just say Adams once again were the Jane Eyre from 2011 and Dangerous Liaisons, and then his bad were The Scarlet Letter from 1995 and Emma.
And my good were Howard's End and Far From the Madding Crowd. And my bad ones were The Other Boleyn Girl and Vanity Fair.
Yes. And we'll be doing our picking for next week's episode at the end of this, so stay tuned for that. But first, we got to thank some people like Chris Oliver for the intro and outro music used in our show. Listen to more of his music at chrisoliver.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Christian Thorlally for our artwork. Follow him at Knight of Water. That's Knight with a K, underscore of, underscore water, over on Twitter, where you can find a link tree to all his great artwork. And of course, we also want to thank our Patreon supporters, patreon.com/DEDBpod, where for just $1 a month, you all get bonus podcasts that we do or get to vote in polls for stuff that we cover, like, of course, the Tulip Fever was your choice, and we appreciate it so much that you were able to give us the opportunity to discuss that. And also, speaking of bonus podcast stuff, we do a show called On the Edge of Relevance, where we cover new releases, and we'll be talking about the Steven Soderbergh film Kimmy, that would have released around this time, so you can hear us talk all about that. I'm very curious about that film. And, of course, we want to thank someone very special here. Manish, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being a guest. Please plug yourself. Where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. When we talked about doing this episode, I was like, man, I kind of want to be like, hey, can we do Sound Sensibility? But I don't want to push it. So I was like, I'll honor your, you know, system. And then it worked out. So it's funny. But you can find me on Twitter at Vertigay314. That's V-E-R-T-I-G-A-Y 314. Also on Letterboxd under my name, Manish Mathur. You can read a lot of my writing at Talk From Society. I also want to plug an episode that I was on of my friend's podcast called The Mixed Reviews, where they go over whole careers of actors and directors and other filmmakers. And I did their episode on Ang Lee. So if you want to hear me talk more about Ang Lee and his entire career, please go find that, The Mixed Reviews. It's a great podcast. I recommend that in general, if you're a fan of film. And also, you can follow my podcast at ItPodsBU. And find that on any streaming app. It's on a bit of a hiatus. We kind of come and go as new romantic films come out. So we did an episode on Licorice Pizza and West Side Story. I'm saying we, but it's me and my guest, who's different every time. So I did an episode on Licorice Pizza and West Side Story most recently, but there's a whole backlog of episodes there. So please check those out. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and your show is great. Particularly, I really liked the recent West Side Story one, where you compare the original 61 movie with the Spielberg adaptation. That was a really stellar episode.
Oh, thank you so much for listening.
We also want to encourage you to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at DEDBpod, and to submit feedback to us over on our email, doubleedgedoublebill@gmail.com, all spelled out. For more of my antics, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at NotTheWho'sTommy. And I also do some writing over at both MarianneThomas.wordpress.com, my blog, and film-cred.com, where I'm a staff writer. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcasting platforms. If you're listening on Talk Film Society, why not listen to all the other great shows like ItPodToBeYou, amongst others. And you can also dig into our archives for several episodes we did before we even joined Talk Film Society on our Podbean main feed. And you know, if you can't support us on the Patreon, the completely free way to help us out is to rate, review, or share the show around, because that gives us more visibility out there. And you know, we'll be doing our picking here for next week, as we often do. Usually Adam and I each have two good movies or two bad movies. We switch up on the quality for that, and we assign numbers between 1 and 10 for them, and then we get, you know, our good and our bad double feature based on that, you know, from the other person choosing the numbers. And there's also, I'll briefly just mention, there is the Godfather rule usually. I think I'm going to recuse that for now, because I do have both Adam's and my choices here, and I have the ability to potentially veto a choice with the Godfather rule. But given I have, you know, knowledge of both of Adam's choices, I'm not going to go ahead and use my veto. I'll just say up front. But when Adam is back, we will potentially be using that in the future. Though, Manish, you have the ability now. You have to pick them between 1 and 10 for both my good choices and Adam's bad choices. So please, first, for my good choices for next week's episode on adventure films, which we're doing because we've got the upcoming Uncharted movie is, I guess, coming out. I still doubt it. Despite that the trailer's coming out, that movie has been in such weird production hell. I'm still not convinced it'll be in a theater. But we're doing adventure films, and so for my two good ones, please pick a number between 1 and 10.
7.
Okay. At number 6, I have one I haven't seen, but I've heard such stellar things about. And I definitely would be curious to see finally from director Peter Weir starring Russell Crowe, Master and Commander.
Ooh, okay, great.
And unfortunately, I'm so sorry, Manish, that my other pick over at number two was Life of Pi. So unfortunately, we couldn't have more Ang Lee, but it was an option there. I do also really quite like that movie quite a bit.
Oh, good. Yeah, excellent. I would love to hear that, but I think Master Commander is a great movie as well.
Well, now for Adam's two bad ones. Please pick a number between 1 and 10.
3.
Okay. Over at number 2, he has the 2005 film Sahara, which I've also never seen. So I don't know. It'll be curious if nothing else. Though on the other side of things, over at number 9, he had Cutthroat Island, the infamous Gina Davis, Rennie Harlan bomb.
I've never seen that either. Sahara, I don't know. It's like a good, like, you know, TNT movie.
It kind of has that energy.
You know, so I'm sure you'll find it. I think you might enjoy it on that level, you know.
Yes. So Sahara and Master and Commander we'll be covering next week. But until then, everybody, please, you know, respect your wonderful British character actors. And really have empathy for them. They really need it whenever they can get it, especially if they're in Tulip Fever. They need all the empathy they can get.